We have two guests tonight. P.J. O'Rourke, the well-known, indeed celebrated political satirist, journalist, all-round man of letters, is one of our guests, and the other is Adam Smith, who is represented by you.
Yes, I'm going to have to channel him since he's been dead for a long time.
How's your Scots burr? Can you do that?
Dead and terrible, just terrible. No, you don't want to hear that. Be even worse than my bagpipe playing.
We assume that he spoke in a Scots accent.
He did not, in fact. He had a standard English accent. He and his Scottish Enlightenment friends in the 18th century, they were lowland Scots. They preferred to call themselves North Britons. They were very much in favor of the then relatively recent union of Scotland and England and Wales to make Great Britain. They did not care for the Highland Scots, the haggis-eating, bagpipe-playing, kilt-wearing bunch, because it was still a feudal area in the north, and the south of Scotland was one of the best-educated places in Europe.
Before we come to the serious stuff, your mention of haggis instantly produces possibly a certain kind of reflexive response, which may have something to do with the gagging. Have you ever actually eaten haggis or even looked into the recipe?
No, I haven't. You know, I mean, Irish cooking is bad enough without going across to my
Do you know what a haggis is?
I do know. It's a sheep's stomach filled with all sorts of things we can't mention on the air.
Well, you can mention the oatmeal.
You can mention the oatmeal.
Exactly. All sorts of other. Dreadful. I once had a slice of it.
Oh, did you really? No, I've never had the courage.
But back to Adam Smith. Let's make clear this as well, that your book is titled On the Wealth of Nations, and The Wealth of Nations, of course, is the title of the original book by Smith, published the same year that we declared our independence, 1776. This is one of the first in a series that is just now beginning of books that have changed the world. That's the way the subtitle runs.
It is a series from Grove Atlantic Press, my publisher. It originated with our we've got a British branch, and the fellow that runs that is a guy named Toby Mundy, and this was his idea. And Toby said that, look, we've got all these, there are these books that have made enormous change. I mean, it really changed people's minds. The Origin of Species, the Quran, the Old Testament, the New Testament, changed the course of history. And yet we really don't read them. And when you plunge into one of these things, I mean, you know, a well-educated person may have been through one or two of these, but none of us is getting through all of them.
We talked about some of those books just last night on this program. We had a program with three great bookies, the president of Scheimer College, a guy from the Great Books Foundation, and so on. And Machiavelli came up, Thucydides, and... let's see. Well, Adam Smith did not come up. He should have been discussed.
Oh, yeah, he should have, yeah. And the thing is, there's a reason that we don't get all the way through these books. I mean, The Wealth of Nations is 900 pages long.
Rather ponderous reading, is it?
It is. In fact, and also to be properly understood, there's a book that Smith wrote before The Wealth of Nations, which is also a great big doorstop, called The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and about how we make our moral judgments and how we can gauge whether those moral judgments are valid and so on and so forth. And that's the whole moral side of our existence, and Wealth of Nations is the material side. And if you read only The Wealth of Nations, you get the idea that Smith was only interested in the material side. Well, that simply happened to be a subject matter there.
At the university, he was defined essentially as a moral philosopher.
He's taught moral philosophy at Glasgow, and that's what he considered himself. And on his tombstone in Edinburgh, it says author of The Theory of Moral Sentiments. Wealth of Nations isn't even mentioned. He considered it much the more important book of the two. So I had to read it all, and the book did not take me, my book did not take me a long time to write, maybe 6 months, and it's going to take people, I hope, a lot less time than that to read it. But the reading that I needed to do to write the book took me a year and a half, and I read pretty good, too, so, for a boy from Toledo, Ohio, then, right?
The another great book is the Talmud. And in the Talmud,
I haven't been through that either.
Maybe you could do that one next time around. And in the Talmud, somebody asks the Rabbi Hillel,
yes,
for whom the Hillel Foundation is
named.
What is the essence of the law, and how can you give that to us while standing on one leg? Which is to say, in a brief, pithy paragraph.
Yeah.
And essentially, he recites a version of the Golden Rule. I now put to you, what is the essence of Smithian economic theory? And can you give it to us as if?
Standing
or if you want to stand
on
one leg right now, do it that way.
And I think I can. It is pursuit of self-interest, division of labor, and freedom of trade.
And they do what?
These are the three things that make the free market successful. And they have to be broadly understood, of course. Here I'm going to try to keep standing on one leg.
Right.
By pursuit of self-interest, Smith doesn't mean simply greed. He means that we naturally do things that work to our advantage. And in fact, we need to. I mean, we have a moral obligation to feed, clothe, and support ourselves. I mean, a naked, starving, homeless us is of no use to society whatsoever. Division of labor involves freedom, and not just putting bolt A into hole B on an assembly line. It also means that we are free to pursue the line of work that we want, or to try to do so, to learn the skills that we deem best to mm-hmm. learn. And freedom of trade doesn't just mean importing cheap plush toys from China. It means that we should be able to go into the marketplace with the goods and the services that we are able to produce, and to freely exchange those goods and services for those that other people can produce without interference, without too much interference.
So that triad, namely self-interest, division of labor, and freedom of trade, all work together. They reinforce each other, as a matter of fact, to yield what ultimate good?
A vast voluntary network of connections. The free market is important not simply because it's efficient or produces more cars or a better standard of living. It's important because the only way we can be free in the world is to have a large voluntary network of associations.
But he argues that this is the way nations get wealthy.
Oh, it is. Yes,
individuals.
Absolutely.
Thus the title, The Wealth of Nations.
Exactly.
The Wealth of Nations is based upon allowing these three related processes full operability.
Yes, and the key question that Smith is trying to answer in The Wealth of Nations, in fact, does answer, is why, what makes nations wealthy.
Mm-hmm.
But he is a moral philosopher, and there's an underlying moral principle to all this, that our individual liberty, is as well as our prosperity, is based on this vast network in which only persuasion is allowed. You see, in the free market, you're not allowed to coerce people. You aren't allowed to hold, you aren't allowed to rob them. You aren't allowed to force them to buy your goods. You're not allowed to have a monopoly.
So that's why he was rather worried about the rise of corporations.
He didn't like corporations a bit. Smith was, there are some interesting things in Smith, and that is one of them. He did not, although he is thought of as the avatar of modern capitalism, he did not foresee the success of the modern joint stock corporation. He detested it. He thought the idea of spreading ownership so thinly in a field that few of the owners truly understood, and allowing the managers of these corporations to have enormous power would result in Enron every single time. And I would say the amazing thing about the modern corporation, if you look at it, is not that it goes wrong sometimes. It goes wrong fairly often. The amazing thing is that it doesn't go wrong. So often doesn't go wrong. And so many of our corporations are rather responsible well, they aren't citizens, really, but they're responsible legal entities for the most part, most of the time, at any rate.
A certain kind of political consciousness with an interest in economic affairs as well, namely a left liberal kind of political consciousness, would say, yes, well and good, but the fact is that the rich get richer and the poor don't, and sometimes if you have full operation of free enterprise and competition, the poor get poorer even as the rich get richer. And there's an awful lot of suffering in the world. And for that matter, rich nations often misuse poor nations as they establish their markets there and bleed those nations for their resources that are available. Therefore, the wealth of nations as pursued in the fashion designed by or argued by Adam Smith makes some nations wealthy, but it has not solved the problem of poverty and misery in the world. In some sense, it has exacerbated poverty and misery in the world.
That would be quite wrong, actually. And it's wrong because it rolls...
Almost all the socialists in the world say that.
Yeah, they do. But the problem with the socialists is that they roll a number of things together that don't necessarily go together. They're quite right about certain things. The rule of law is absolutely necessary. Free market, in fact, a free society, paradoxically requires the coercion of law. And Smith was a very strong advocate for the rule of law. He was not a pure libertarian. He didn't. He never used the phrase laissez-faire. It appears nowhere in his writing. He knew the phrase. He was friends with the French physiocrats who popularized the phrase laissez-faire. He never used it. Nor did he believe in it. He believed that in rule of law. He believed that certain regulations were absolutely necessary in order for us to have the free markets and have them function. One thing that Smith was very strong on pointing out, which I would say is the core error of socialist thinking, is that wealth is not zero sum. Smith said that, you know, by means of division of labor, by means of trade, and by means of a regulated pursuit of self-interest, and indeed by means of labor-saving devices, we can create more wealth. Wealth is not a fixed amount. It's not a matter of if I have too many slices of pizza, you have to eat the Domino's box. He, of course, had never had a pizza. He was eating haggis, but you know what I mean. And that was actually an extremely important insight, because in the 18th century, there was an idea that wealth was a fixed matter. And, of course, it came out, it wasn't a stupid idea. It came from an agrarian society. The world was just emerging from an agrarian economy in the 18th century. And when all wealth was produced by land, wealth was zero sum. The land that I had was land you couldn't have, and vice versa. But Smith perceived that the world was changing and becoming far more sophisticated, and that we shouldn't be measuring things in zero sum terms.
To see how Smith was thinking and the relevance of his thought, and to put it in its historical context, one might very well compare him to another thinker in the same realm, who also had great influence at more or less the same time, namely the Reverend Thomas Malthus.
Yes, and Smith was rather opposed to Malthus's ideas. And it's interesting.
Malthus takes a much darker view.
Malthus takes a much darker view. He feels that while we can increase our production of food and other goods arithmetically, we reproduce in a way that is geometrical, mm-hmm. and that population will soon outrun. And he meant soon. Interestingly enough, Malthus modified his own views late in his life. The last revision of Malthus's work took a much more moderate view. He, in fact, said, I've been wrong here. It turns out that I still worry about this, but it turns out that mankind's cleverness at producing much more foods and good, it was much greater than I had.
Now, another crucial term, and another crucial set of institutions that must be invoked right now, so that we may ask, what did Adam Smith say about those institutions, is government or governance.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, he had views as to what government ought to do, or rather, more particularly, what government ought not to do with regard to the operation of free trade, division, divided labor, and self-interest.
He felt that government should stay out of these things as much as possible. He felt that the purpose of government was to guarantee our freedoms, and that government regulation, he understood the motive for it, but he thought that it often resulted, and of course we've seen this over and over, in unintended consequences and in defeating its own purpose. Smith was acutely aware that political power, unlike economic power, is zero sum. The political power that I have is political power that you can't have. And that's not true of the wealth that I have. The wealth that I have doesn't affect the wealth that you have, at least at a theoretical level. But the political power that I have definitely does affect. And so he strongly wanted a limitation of political power. He was a Whig. Interestingly, would have been called a liberal. A Whig then would be a liberal now. But the real meaning of Whig was that he was in favor of limiting the power of the king and increasing the power of the parliament.
Meanwhile, across the ocean, at more or less the same time, well, certainly in the very year that his book, The Wealth of Nations, was published, the American Republic is getting underway. Was it Thomas Jefferson who got off the maxim that government governs best which governs least?
I think so, but I wouldn't want to swear to that.
The view that you kind of convey in this book, adding your own intensity to the Smithian argument, is that government governs best which gets out of the way just about completely.
Not really.
Except for the administration of law and necessary military defense.
Necessary military defense, of course, is one of the things we all always depend upon. We depend upon the government to keep the peace, both from exterior threats and interior threats, you know, to fight crime and to fight enemies. But Smith was also very strong on the government providing law, jurisprudence, and property rights. It had to enforce and enforcing contract.
So all these guys had read Hobbes, don't you think?
Oh, they had.
And they were very frightened by the Hobbesian vision of the war of all against all.
They certainly were. They were scared of the notion of anarchy. Jefferson rather less than some of the other founding fathers, but they were all frightened of the idea of anarchy. And, of course, I've been a foreign correspondent for years and years, and I've seen some anarchy, and I'll tell you, it is scary. I've been to Somalia. I've been to Lebanon in the midst of its civil war. You don't want anarchy.
And it would be anarchic for us not to pay proper attention to our sponsors.
Absolutely.
Who are waiting in the wings at this very moment.
That would be a violation of all free market principles.
So a quick pause for some of those messages, then directly back to P.J. O'Rourke, continuing to draw from his book On the Wealth of Nations, though I think we might take the lessons that you have from Smith and ask how well they apply to the rectification of present problems in the economic realm, and for that matter, how they might apply to yet other present problems, because what works in the economy or what doesn't work in the economy has consequences in other sectors, surely, of the total society.
Absolutely.
Directly back then to P.J. O'Rourke and Adam Smith after this. And my guest tonight is P.J. O'Rourke, well known to all in this country, all who read at all, for his satirical commentary, also for his serious reportage from various places around the world, and for many other books, many of them wonderful assemblages of essays that usually set you laughing, even though the topics are rather serious.
We try. It's always been my feeling that there's that earnestness shouldn't be confused with seriousness. Mm-hmm. You know, when a person is serious, a person is serious involuntarily. I mean, if you get run over by a bus, you'll be serious about it. There's just no doubt. Seriousness is saying this is important. Mm-hmm. Earnestness is saying I'm important for saying that this is important. You know?
I must tell you, for a number of years after I arrived in Chicago and taking a job at the University of Chicago, I often ran into a man who would be called, I would suppose, the Smithian of the latter day, namely Milton Friedman.
A huge hero of mine, and absolutely, I don't think until I read all of Smith, and I mean Moral Sentiments as well as The Wealth of Nations, I didn't really realize how much Milton Friedman owed to Adam Smith.
He did realize how much he owed.
He did. Yeah. Yes, he said so repeatedly.
Sure.
But I didn't fully fathom it until
he was often on this program until he left us to move west and settle in at Stanford and at the Hoover Institution. But if you go to his book, Capitalism and Freedom, which is the popular book of his, which most closely parallels, I would say, The Wealth of Nations, is there any deviation in the argument, or is it essentially just an updating of the same argument?
Well, Friedman is dealing with a very different kind of governmental situation.
And he's dealing also with the corporate world.
He's dealing with the corporate world, and he's dealing with post-industrial revolution. Mm-hmm. So some things about it are very different. Interesting fact about Smith was that he didn't foresee the Industrial Revolution, and not only didn't he foresee it, he didn't foresee it while being personal friends with Isaac Watt, while Watt was inventing the steam engine that would cause the Industrial Revolution. It goes to show that genius will only take you so far.
Well, some great inventions like the steam engine are sometimes first classified as sort of harmless toys.
And I think that was Smith's. Smith understood that it was important, but he didn't understand. He sort of understood that it was qualitatively important. He didn't understand how quantitatively important it would be. He actually thought the Industrial Revolution had happened already.
So what has Friedman done to alter the argument so as to fit the present time?
Well, Friedman, by needs must, deal with government regulatory behavior of a kind that was unimaginable in Smith's time. There's a funny little line, and just Smith sort of tosses off in consideration of tax policy. He said something about like a consumption tax or sales tax, and he's saying, well, you couldn't do that. It would mean much too much sort of poking your nose into people's private business. No one would stand for such a thing as a sales tax. He thought, gosh, the world has changed. And it also made me think, we're so proud of all the freedoms that we have today, many more freedoms than the England of the 18th century had. But it does remind us that that we may have dropped a few freedoms while we were stooping to pick up new ones.
Are there Smithian theorists lodged in the middle of political organizations? Is, in America, the Republican Party truly more committed to free trade and to the decent and honest pursuit of self-interest than is the Democratic Party? Might the same be said of the Conservative Party as compared to the Labour Party in the UK?
The answer to that is yes, but not nearly enough so. Mm-hmm. Both political parties in America, and I think this can be said too of the both political parties of significance in Britain, are highly statist. It is in the self-interest, to use a Smithian term, of politicians to expand the power and province of politics to enlarge. This is something that's called public choice economics.
Gather ye power while ye may, old time is still a-flying. You may not rule the country before you die.
There it is. Yeah. And there's a fellow whose name is eluding me, a University of Virginia guy who did some wonderful work on this. Buchanan was his name, not Patrick. Mm-hmm. Did this work on taking an economic look at bureaucracies and politics. And he said that just like any other business, they try to grow. They try to expand their power.
Now it's time to place you on the political dimension. And I will now inform all the world, though many of them already know this, that if one were to classify you, you are neither a Democrat nor a Republican. You are, in fact, a gasp. Libertarian.
I am. I mean, I'm nominally a Republican because we have these two broad political. We don't really have parties the way Europeans have parties, where you have a car.
But you do define yourself as a libertarian, and you are now.
I am a libertarian.
You hold a chair at the leading sort of think tank for libertarians, the Cato Institute.
I am the H.L. Mencken a research fellow. It's a little bit of a joke. They don't pay me anything, and I'm worth it. I very much am a libertarian.
And we'll talk more about that. I want to get your fix on just what libertarianism means these days. How it relates, indeed, to the principles that Smith laid down for us. As we return after an update on the news, then some quick commercials, and now to the newsroom, and we return to P.J. O'Rourke. And, P.J., put on your Adam Smith identity.
Okay.
And if Adam were with us and you could use your received pronunciation, you don't have to use a Scots burr, obviously. What would he be saying about the world that you've been showing him over the last week or so?
Oh, gee, sometimes it's tempting to put too much, you find a really brilliant thinker and a clear and brilliant thinker who's morally incisive and sort of authoritative about a lot of things. And sometimes there's a temptation to put too much weight upon it. I would say this is sort of the born-again Christian temptation. Mm-hmm. The Bible is a wonderful, wonderful book, but you can't go to it to decide which phone service to use. You can't put too much burden.
And you can't figure out the present dilemma by going to the Wealth of Nations? Is that what you're suggesting?
Not always. I mean, for instance, when it comes to something like outsourcing jobs, what would Smith have thought about that? Well, in principle... he would be very much in favor of broadening the market. He said one of the ways we become wealthy is by broadening the marketplace. The wider the marketplace is, the more opportunities we have in the marketplace. And the whole business of outsourcing jobs, of course, is a broadening of the marketplace. It's an increase in the division of labor. It's part of the thing to make the free market work. On the other hand, Smith, writing about the high tariff barriers of his own time, pointed out that however good it may be to eliminate those tariff barriers, you must be careful about the pace at which you do it. to suddenly eliminate all tariff barriers, you say, would be to destroy the work of decades of the people who had built their investments, planned their lives, had designed their whole system of operations, their businesses, to conform to tariff barriers that they assumed would always be there. So he said, you have to be very, every change that you make in jurisprudence of this kind is going to be is going to harm people, even if it's a good change.
I said just before those commercials, I wanted to talk with you about libertarianism and about your own take on libertarianism. Let me get into that by asking you, if he were living today, would he, Smith, be attracted to libertarianism as a way of kind of defining the broad stance in life?
I think in general he would, but I think he might be a kind of confused by some of the social issues. The libertarian position of...
He wouldn't agree with you that it would be appropriate to legalize marijuana.
For instance, I think that he would be, that he was a little bit too old-fashioned and a little bit of an ordinary, rather prudish. He wasn't a prudish man, but he was a conventional man and a conservative man in a small C sense.
Well, another very conservative man whom you know and who's written a hell of a lot is William Buckley, who indeed, among other things, favors the legalization of marijuana.
I do worry about it because, you know, just from what I've studied of economics, I know that if you lower the cost of anything, and cost is not just money, of course. Cost is also bother, and cost is getting arrested.
And legal risk, sure.
Yeah. If you lower the cost of anything, you will sell more of that product. And that anybody who thinks that legalizing marijuana will decrease the use of marijuana is blowing smoke. And we know just what kind of smoke. So I do happen to favor the legalization of marijuana because I think that the barn door is open and the horse is gone.
What else do you favor that others might oppose, but favor by virtue of your starting from a libertarian analysis of the whole situation?
Civil union for gay couples, for instance, contract law. From a legal point of view, from a political point of view, marriage is simply a contract. There's also a religious aspect to marriage, and that's why I wouldn't say, I mean, as a reasonably religious person and a poor Catholic, but a Catholic nonetheless, I couldn't say I favor gay marriage, but marriage is a religious institution. As far as the political institution of marriage, the contractual side of it, I don't see why any two consenting adults, why they should be discriminated against in terms of what kind of contract they can form.
Well, some president Republicans essentially would take that position. Apparently, Rudy Giuliani is close to that position you just enunciated. Maybe both of them.
Yeah.
Where then do sort of permissive Republicans differ from libertarians, or vice versa? Where do libertarians differ from them?
Well, I think libertarians are much more alert to the problems that politics causes. A politician cannot go before the public, cannot go before the voters and say there are a whole bunch of things that politics simply can't fix. For example, a politician cannot go up in front of the public and say, the problem with public education is not overcrowded classrooms, it's not teachers' unions, it's not lack of computer equipment in the classrooms, it's not lack of a voucher system, the problem is your damn kids. A politician simply can't say that, and a libertarian can. That's one of the benefits.
Is it your damn kids?
Your
damn failure as a parent.
Well, there you go. The damn kids come from someplace, don't they?
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I think that the worst school systems in America have some excellent students in them, and the reason would be the parents. Sidney Lumet was once upon a time my father-in-law, my previous marriage, and a wonderful man. And Sidney Lumet, and I agree about nothing about politics. He's very left-wing. But we do
like
agree.
All famous Hollywood directors.
Yes, of course. And he's a guy who grew up on the Lower East Side of New York, and he grew up in very, very tough circumstances. But Sidney used to tell about there was a library, there still is a branch library on Houston Street in New York. And I used to live right around the corner from it when I first came to New York. And it's all has bars, graffiti all over it, and bars on the windows now. And Sidney said that used to, on Saturday mornings, there would be a line around the block of kids from the Lower East Side waiting to get into that library. And those were poor kids. And I don't think the New York school system was so hunky-dory back in Sidney's day in the 1920s and 1930s either.
As we continue talking about American politics and more broadly about the way we live now and your views of how we live now and what's happening in this country and the world, I offer you a quotation. It's very well known. I wonder, in fact, if you can identify the man who first said this. And it is, one who is not a socialist at 20 has no heart, and one who remains a socialist at 40 has no head.
Winston Churchill.
This is what's so interesting about this. It's attributed to Winston Churchill, though I read you the form of it attributed to Bernard Shaw.
Oh, is that right?
I just did some research on it today.
Now who really said that first?
Well, that's what I'm about to reveal. But only after I first tell you this, which amused me so much. There's a guy named Mark T. Shirey who has a website called Unquote, in which he takes famous quotations which are attributed to many, many different persons. He gives you versions of this same basic aphorism. The first one he gives you is from Winston Churchill. If a man is not a socialist, by the time he's 20, he has no heart. If he is not a conservative, by the time he's 40, he has no brain. That's Churchill.
That's the one that I would...
Others who've had this attributed to them are Wendell Willkie, George Bernard Shaw, Aristide Briand, a former French premier. Let me go on here for just a moment. William Casey of the CIA.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. Woodrow Wilson. The Wilson version is interesting. Anyone who's not a socialist at 16 has no heart, but anyone who still is a socialist at 32 has no mind. Shorter lifespan of those days.
It must have been, yeah. Or more engaged 16-year-olds or
and
something.
Listen to this one. He who is not a socialist at 19 has no heart. He who is still a socialist at 30 has no brain. This one is amazing in its attribution. Otto von Bismarck, the premier of Germany. And so on. We have yet Georges Clemenceau, another French premier, has it attributed to him. But the ultimate source, apparently, is François Guizot, who is yet another French premier, but of an earlier vintage. His dates were 1787 to 1874, and the quotation attributed to him is not to be a Republican at 20 is a Republican, meaning in the French terms...
An anti-royalist.
Yeah. And in some sense, what we would call a liberal.
Yeah.
Not to be a Republican at 20 is proof of a want of heart. To be one at 30 is proof of a want of head.
Well, I'll be darned. I think he wins, don't you?
Guizot does, just by virtue of the earliest citation.
Yeah, but because the that political division hardly exists before his time. So,
oh, by the way, it's also attributed to Benjamin Disraeli. But I've been through all of that simply to say that this certainly applies to you as well. And some of your wonderful writing that I've enjoyed over the years is various articles in which you give an account of your adventures on the left as a very young man.
It's true, although I came from a perfectly conventional Republican background, I must say, and I was kind of swept out to sea by that great tide of nonsense that was the 1960s, mm-hmm. and I kind of went along, I didn't kind of, I very much did go along with what people were thinking.
While you were doing that in college, I was an assistant professor.
Oh, my gosh.
College,
and I feel sorry
watching
for
these kids tearing up the place.
Yes. Yeah, we were a bunch of idiots. We really were. I actually think that this greatest generation, this well-known greatest generation, has an awful lot to answer for because they, after all, are our parents. The greatest generation did lead directly to the not-so-hot-so generation that I belong to. So, we didn't come from nowhere. But we certainly must have seemed to have come from nowhere.
What was your college?
Miami of Ohio. Hardly a hotbed of
in what class? What year?
I was class of 1969.
Uh-huh. That was just about when it really got underway.
Oh, it was. And it hit even Miami, yeah. As a matter of fact.
And you found that that's where you met all the girls.
That was precisely what happened to me. I was a freshman year, 1965, at Miami of Ohio. I was walking down an alley. In those days, you could drink beer at 18. And I was walking down an alley, and there were two bars. And on the bar on one side was it had sort of the fraternity and sorority kids in it. And they were very good-looking girls over there, and but also very good-looking guys, and rather better dressed than I was, and it looked like they had, you know, came from better, you know, and I wasn't going to cut it over there. They looked like they were successful athletes and came from nice families and so on. On the other side of the alley was another bar, and that was filled with people strumming on guitars and wearing their hair over their collars, and girls in black leotards with little ballet shoes on and that sort of thing. And I looked over there, and I thought, girls who ironed their hair and, and smoked unfiltered cigarettes. And I thought, you know, I bet I do better over on that side of the alley. I'll bet those girls do it.
So that's how they lured you onto the barricade.
They did indeed.
What were some of the main points in your career as a student radical? Some of the main adventures.
I think my main adventure was getting a big red fist sort of stenciled on the back of my jean jacket and growing my hair out to an ungodly length, and going home and being confronted by my extremely Republican grandmother, who was from downstate Illinois, from Mattoon, Illinois. And grandma said, "Pat, I'm worried about you. Are you becoming a Democrat?" And I said, "Grandma, of course I'm not a Democrat. Lyndon Johnson is a fascist pig. Of course I'm not a Democrat. I am a communist." And my grandmother said, "Just as long as you're not a Democrat." And you know, I never was a Democrat. I went from Republican to communist, right back to Republican.
Now, you got out of school in 69.
Yeah.
And you entered into a writing career directly. You must have been writing when you were in college as well. So was your radicalism reflected in your early journalism?
Oh, sure. I went to the first job. You know, it didn't really pay, but the first regular writing work that I did was for an underground newspaper, as we used to say, in Baltimore, where I was in graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And I was writing all sorts of furious anti-war, anti-capitalist, anti-fascist pig.
Screeds,
yes, yeah. Screeching and yelling. And then one night, our little newspaper office got taken over by people who were considered themselves to be far more radical than we were. Because I will say, although we thought
that would have been the Maoist faction, probably
exactly. They actually called themselves, and I'm not kidding. They called themselves the Balto Kong. They took over our office. And they said, "We're liberating it for the people." And we tried to explain to them that all that we had were about three typewriters and about $10,000 in debt and this little row house that we were months and months behind on the rent. And they were welcome to all of it. They could liberate away, you know. And they couldn't quite. And they kind of held us at knuckle point and put us through consciousness-raising sessions, did a lot of screaming and yelling at us and telling us how they were going to taking this publication over for the people.
By the way, were those girls wearing leotards as well?
No, I don't remember what they were.
They were a little grubbier.
They were a little grubbier than that, yeah. They were just, yes, they were sort of wearing more work boots. And the only thing that kept us from being thrown out of our little crash pad there was that two of the actual people happened to stop by. This is, you know, 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock at night. And there were these two black kids from the neighborhood. I think they were like high school seniors. And they were just nice, really nice kids. And they were English majors. And they had been kind of bugging us at the newspaper to publish some of their poetry. These are two hopelessly clean-cut kids. Anyway, they walked in on this scene of these people yelling at us and threatening to punch us and so on. And they said, "You know, what the hell's going on here?" And these two black kids, two very nice black English major kids from the neighborhood, scared the dickens out of the Balto Kong, who freaked out, thought they were going to be shot or stabbed or something, and skedaddled out of the office and ran away. And thus we were saved by a pair of English majors. And after that, we did publish their poetry.
This is a rarity.
That's your cell phone. I want everybody to know that's Milt's cell phone.
Well, we'll fast.
Not mine. I don't even have one on me.
Yeah. Was that the beginning of your enlightenment?
You know, there, a friend of mine guy I still know, tells me, I don't remember this, but he tells me that the whole next day I was wandering around the newspaper office, slamming my fist into the desk, saying, Spiro Agnew was right, Spiro Agnew was right. So I think that was kind of the beginning of my disillusionment, although it took a number of years before I realized that, you know, that I was on the wrong side of the question.
There was a transition period.
A long, rather long transition period, because I think it was still romantic in the early 70s to identify oneself with the left. You know, they were the good guys. They were Rick in Casablanca. You know what I mean? And of course, the Vietnam War was not the best thought out thing that the American government had ever done. And in fact, I lost several friends over there. And they made a, you know, the government made its attempt to draft me, and which I managed to successfully resist by explaining to them. I went down to the draft physical and explained to them just how many drugs I took and how often. And at the end of which they said, get out of here. We don't want you in the Army.
You did have such a period.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Heavy stuff, not just marijuana.
Well, marijuana, LSD, mescaline, you know, sort of whatever, you know, whatever came my way. And it took me, and it was, I think as the 70s wore on, I began to realize that I wasn't in, that really I'd rather have a scotch, you know, and that was another moment, you know, when I started to move, you know, to the right.
I know that in your career, rather early on, you began traipsing around the world, got out of this country, began looking at other places.
Not so early, really.
By mid-career, at least.
Yeah, it was, I had worked in New York at the old National Lampoon magazine, and had eventually become editor of the magazine.
And I said when I introduced this program before you came into the studio that the person who's just done a book interpreting Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations is the former editor of the National Lampoon.
All odd career turns.
Yeah.
And I had quit at the National Lampoon in the beginning about 81 and didn't really know what I was going to do. I just felt I'd gotten a little old for, you know, there's a certain kind of humor like The Onion, and which I happen to enjoy a lot, and Saturday Night Live and stuff. And it's really, you need to be young.
Sure.
You have to be old enough to be good at doing the humor, but you have to be young enough to still feel that you're an outsider. And you're still standing in the flower bed, looking through the dining room window, making faces at the grown-ups who are sitting around the table.
Lovely image, yeah.
And then one day you realize that you're getting a little tall to be standing with the other kids out there. And you really ought to be at the table, having dinner with the other grown-ups. And it was Michael Kinsley, founder of Slate Magazine, who was then running Harper's, who sent me to the Soviet Union in 1982, and that was my first overseas assignment. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what got into Michael, but I thank him all the time for doing
Were
that.
Were you still left-leaning?
No.
You started
no, I had really moved over pretty far to you know, to kind of a, you know, conservative libertarian.
But you're able to look at the Soviet Union with with unblinkered eyes. So
absolutely, and the more so because it was Kinsley's idea was to send me along on a cruise put together by The Nation magazine. So I was over there with all these old leftists. I mean old
was
leftists.
Was Vic Nevasky on board?
He wasn't, but he might have, but he was there in spirit.
Yeah.
I mean, these were people.
He's an unrepentant lefty at the age of 80, probably.
Absolutely. Yeah. And these were people who were still arguing about the Hitler-Stalin Pact. And I mean, they were still, bitterly divided. You know, some were Trotskyites and some were, you know, who knows what. But I mean, these were people in their 70s. And of course, I was quite young. I thought 70 was immensely old. Doesn't look quite so old anymore. But now that I'll be 60 this year, 70 is the prime of life. But at any rate, they seemed very old to me, and they were still quarreling about all this stuff. And they were just hilarious. And there was one moment on this trip that kind of changed my whole career. We were going through on this cruise boat through the Don Volga Canal. I'm standing at the railing with a very, very old, very left-wing sort of Stalinist woman. And she is admiring this lock that we're going through, which is just a big cement, you know, trough.
Mm-hmm.
And she's looking up at this big wall of cement, and she's going, oh, the Soviets, they're such engineers. They are such engineers, such wonderful engineers, the Soviets are. And I'm going, yeah, it's, you know, nice big wall of cement. And then she looks over the railing of the boat, and she looks down, and she goes, and where do they get all the water? And I thought, this is the best. I never have to do another thing. I never have to write another joke as long as I live. I just hang around weird people and keep my ears open. And that's basically what I've been doing ever since.
You've been in the Middle East a good deal.
I have. Starting in, I went over to cover the civil war in Lebanon in 1984, and again in 85 when the TWA plane was kidnapped to Beirut. And I covered the first Gulf War, this last war.
Of course, the Middle East is at the center of our unease, at the center of our preoccupation with the darkness of the world these days in many sectors of the Middle East. When we return from an update on the news, which is coming almost instantly, I'd like to get your reflections on the present situation, and for that matter, your experience over the last few decades. We return to P.J. O'Rourke, but now to the newsroom for a full update from Paula Cooper. Our guest tonight is P.J. O'Rourke, and I'm taking advantage of his presence to go beyond his new book, which is indeed easy to recommend to all who favor and enjoy lucid writing and writing that has some heart in it, and in this case has some high-level quippery in it. You can do that even with Adam Smith. P.J. O'Rourke's new book is titled On the Wealth of Nations, and it is published by Atlantic Press. Is that right?
Grove Atlantic, yes.
Grove Atlantic,
I think this one came out under just Atlantic. I get confused myself, but the parent company is Grove Atlantic.
Atlantic Monthly Press, it says on the cover sheet. Now then, back to the Middle East. Anywhere you want to go. You've been there on and off over the years.
Yeah.
Can you make any sense out of it?
Oh, yeah, it makes sense. You've got a bunch of people who really hate each other, and they're good at it. You know, I think that my own Irish heritage is a little bit of a help here. I covered the Troubles a little bit in Northern Ireland in the 80s. And one of the things that dawned on me when I was up there in Belfast, they enjoy it. They like to fight. You know, people do like to fight. There's a reason that the history of mankind is to such a large extent the history of war. Obviously, not everybody likes to fight. And some civilizations, I would like to hope, have gotten a little bit beyond the love of fighting.
John Hersey's last novel, I believe, was titled The War Lover.
The War Lover, yes. I remember it quite well. I liked it. And you know, it happens. The Middle East is a highly politicized place. People really do feel that what they're fighting over is zero sum, that they won't get, that they will be eliminated, that if they don't get political power, they will be destroyed, literally killed, as was the case with the Shiites and the Kurds under Saddam Hussein. They really do feel that they're fighting for their lives, and they're proud to fight for their lives. They're very brave. I wouldn't say it was the best organized place in the world. I wouldn't say there's a famous phrase that's been used both about Arabs and about Jews in Israel, is that if you put two Arabs in a room, you get three political parties. I've heard Israelis say exactly the same thing about Israelis. You know, if you put two Israelis.
Let me put you on the spot with something. How did you feel about the original American entry into Iraq?
I was in favor of it. I was in favor of it because I had seen what the Iraqis, what Saddam Hussein had done to Kuwait. I had gotten into Kuwait during the ground war, during the Gulf War. I had accidentally gone right through the front lines from Saudi Arabia and wound up in Kuwait City before the Allied troops arrived.
You say you were in favor. You mean you were in favor of our action in 91?
No, I was in favor of our action in 2003.
George W.'s action.
Action. Because I felt Saddam Hussein was, I felt this was my analysis of the situation, which I'm willing now to admit was probably wrong. I felt there was a bad man, that he was running a bad country, that had done a number of bad things, that had the material resources to do more bad things, and seemed entirely likely that they would do more bad things. I wasn't particularly convinced by the weapons of mass destruction argument or by I didn't at all believe that there was any connection between al-Qaeda. In fact, al-Qaeda hated Saddam Hussein also, at least as much as George W. did. But I thought that that was, we had a very unstable part of the world and a very bad man running a very wealthy part of that unstable place, and I thought that he should be eliminated. I did not foresee the extent of the quantity, the sheer quantity of worms that were in that can. Yeah. You know?
You told me a story before we came on the air about you and what's his name, Mike Kelly?
Mike Kelly, who's the editor of the Atlantic, my then boss.
The two of you went over there together right after the taking of Baghdad.
Well, actually, we went there before the war started. We went to Kuwait.
As they were staging it.
As they were getting ready for the war. And we didn't know what to do about the embed situation. We were both a little skeptical about the embed, because you feel that if you embed with a group of soldiers and they save your life three or four times, or what? Are you going to tell on them, you know, because they did something bad? Of course you're not going to. But anyway, we decided that I would be the outside guy. I would be the unilateral, and Mike would embed, because he had covered the 3rd Infantry Battalion when they had been in Bosnia, and so he knew the people. So the night before Mike went in for his embed, and the last time I saw him alive, he said to me, he said, PJ, you know how this is going to work out. The war is going to start, and you're going to be free to do whatever you want. I'm going to be stuck with the 911th Latrine Cleaning Battalion, and you're going to be driving through liberated Iraq in your rent-a-car, judging wet abaya contests, you know, and drinking George W. Bush beer. Well, that's not how things turned out. Mike went with the 3rd Infantry Division, I think I said battalion earlier.
And was killed.
And was killed.
A journalist was killed. Yeah.
During the taking of the of the Baghdad airport. And after Mike died, it was awful. In the first place, he was a close friend. I mean, and I was just devastated. Our families knew each other. His kids about the same age as my kids. And I had to make the worst phone call in my life. I had to call my wife and tell her that Mike was dead. She was very fond of Mike. And then I had to tell her that I was going up to Baghdad to take Mike's place. And that's not a phone call I'd care to make again. Mm-hmm. She's a daughter of a career FBI agent, and she's a tough chick, and you know, she didn't do what a lot of wives would under the circumstances.
Let me fast forward to right now. How do you feel about our situation at the moment? And do you see a way out with honor, and perhaps even with some achievement to show for all that we have expended?
No, I don't. And this is the thing that's just, you know, I mean, there are moments when I'm just so glad that I am a lowly journalist, and it's not my job to make these kind of policy decisions, because I wouldn't know what the hell to do. We have a situation where I fear if we leave, it will make Darfur look like a walk in the park. There could be terrible, terrible bloodshed, internecine killing. Their sectarian killings, so just extraordinary extent if we were to walk out, and yet to stay doesn't seem to be working either. I'm not very confident about this surge. I'm not sure what 20,000 extra troops will do or how long that it will. I think this thing was very seriously misjudged, and I got to say, I was one of the people who misjudged it. I'm not a Middle East expert, but I'm familiar enough with the Middle East that I suppose I at least thought that my opinion counted for something. I will say this, I even at the time, I remember saying to a friend of mine at ABC News the night before I left for Kuwait, during the staging of the Iraq War. I remember saying to him, don't you hope that somebody smarter than we are has figured this all out? And he said, I sure do. And I guess, unfortunately, someone smarter than us hadn't.
Well, some smart guys that I know who are area experts, or else are military strategic types, do argue that we're in by no means as disadvantageous a position as is commonly represented by the critics. That you won't get what was perhaps originally dreamed of, a duplicate somehow of the government of Vermont.
And, no,
and with nice town meetings and general civility and so on. But a basic change has been made in the Middle East, which change in the long run can only work to produce, if not democratization, at least a kind of creeping secularization, which will serve the Middle East and its residents well and ultimately will serve the world well. The one flaw in that whole argument is that at the moment it looks as if Iran, which is on a mad non-secularist tear, may well have been very significantly strengthened and may now have developed aspirations to build a Shiite crescent across the Middle East.
You know, I hope those experts are right, but I fear that they may not be. I fear that that we may be have created a sort of huge advertisement for fundamentalist Islamic ideas. You know, we shouldn't feel too smug about when we think about that kind of fundamentalism. We've seen a number of expressions of that kind of religious fundamentalism within our own religions. I mean, you know, Catholic, Protestant, and Jew can all point to examples of this kind of fundamentalism within our own belief system.
Two of the guys who essentially take the view that I've just been summarizing all too briefly, you probably know both of them, Vic Hansen, Victor Davis Hansen, and Fred Kagan, who helped to design the current surge strategy.
Yeah, I don't know them. I know who they are.
And they write in those terms.
Yeah.
It's almost time for us to pause for some commercials, but before that, it is time for me to now invite telephone calls and emails. We've talked about a lot with P.J. O'Rourke tonight, so we could talk about Adam Smith and about ultimate theories of how do you get a workable wealth-building economy and how that relates to the maintenance of democratic institutions. We could talk about radicalism and how we all go through it and some come out of it alive and transformed. Or we could talk about the Middle East, or we could talk, as we have not yet done, but I know you've got much to say on it, about present American politics.
Oh, there's that.
There's a great deal there to be talked about.
And how.
And for any and all such topics, if you want to pose a question or even offer a brief thought, we'd be delighted to hear from you. And with that, we will pause for a round of commercials and then directly on to your contributions. And we will go directly to the phones after I quickly reintroduce our guest for the evening. It is none other than P.J. O'Rourke, and we're drawing from his latest book, On the Wealth of Nations. And that's in the series titled Books That Change the World, published by Atlantic Press. Good evening. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
I'm curious to know if Adam Smith ever expressed his views on imperialism that was taking place in his era, and also human slavery or bondage, and how the role it played in the economic development of, say, North America and the Caribbean, the sugar trade, that whole thing that was going on in that era. Did he say anything about that?
Absolutely. Smith was a very early anti-colonialist, anti-imperialist. He hated it. And he hated it on both a moral level and a practical level. He thought that it was that the British then, you know, I mean, not just British, the whole European idea, that they could make themselves rich by conquering these countries elsewhere and essentially enslaving the populations of those countries was absolutely ridiculous. And he felt it was also morally offensive. On slavery, the same thing. He made arguments both moral and material against slavery. One of the interesting things about the fact that there are two Smith books rather than one is that if you read only The Wealth of Nations, you'll only hear his economic arguments against slavery, which are good. I mean, basically, he says people think slavery is such a great deal. All they have to do is give a little food and a few rags of clothing to the slave, and the slave does everything for them. He said, but in point of fact, that slave is motivated to sabotage, to undercut, to thwart everything that his alleged owner has set out to do. And you think, well, this is a pretty good argument against slavery, but it's kind of cold-blooded. Well, the passionate moral argument is in the prior book, is in the theory of moral sentiments. So Smith was very early advocate of human equality and a very early advocate of anti-imperialism.
Thank you very much.
We thank you, sir, for the call. Back to the phones in just a moment. Let me go to the email. Question to you. Who said, quote, the great vice of capitalism is the unequal sharing of plenty. The great virtue of communism is the equal sharing of misery.
I think that was Winston Churchill.
this listener asked, was it Churchill?
That's my impression. I believe that was Churchill. And I sort of see what Churchill meant, but I think that the important thing that we have found out in subsequent times is that that actually isn't the key vice. We know what the vices of communism are. Those are well proven.
Well, it killed a lot of people.
It killed a lot of people, just for starts. The key vice to capitalism seems to be human nature, is that free societies have not yet figured out how to deal with social pathologies. We have figured out how to produce enough material goods to make a decent, not necessarily luxurious, but a decent life for everybody. We have not figured out how to make everybody behave in such a way as to obtain a decent life. And one of the tragedies of America today is that, excepting some illegal immigrants and people in certain special circumstances, almost every poor person in America, there's a social pathology behind it, either a social pathology that they have, or that the people who are responsible, that is to say their parents or, you know, or the people who are supposed to be caring for them, have.
Well, as a conservative or even as a libertarian, surely you would also agree with the general view, I think, that is commonly attributed to Burke, that human nature and thus human society is or are radically imperfectible.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say that as a Christian. I mean, as a religious person, the man is fallen. I mean, there is an evil aspect to man. It's manifest all around the world.
When it comes to sayings about, or for that matter, from the Soviet Union, my favorite is the one attributed to Soviet workers who say, one of them supposedly once said to some American journalist, they pretend to pay us, and we pretend to work.
Yes. I suppose, actually, that was Smith's key argument against slavery or against, you know, indentured servitude and against economic exploitation of all kinds, is that what you'll wind up with. If you set out to exploit your employees, you will wind up with employees who have just that attitude.
By the way, going back to the email from this fellow, he goes on to say, PJ is a great guest, interesting, smart, and funny. I've enjoyed many of his books. With the election season off to an early start, does he have a favorite populist demagogue yet?
Favorite populist demagogue. I think you're going to find that they will all be populist demagogues by the time that they're done. I've got to say, it's a little bit of a thin field. Personally, I happen to like John McCain. I know John McCain. I consider him to be like a really decent and courageous man. I don't agree with him about everything. But if I had to vote just on the basis of character.
Does any of those 15 or such that are now out in the field talking about wanting to be president, does any of them give you the shivers?
Oh,
John Kerry apparently did affect you that way.
Yes, John Kerry bothered me a lot. There was some, but I had met Kerry. I had met Kerry years ago in Manila during the Marcos overthrow, and I had disliked him intensely then. He was part of an American group that was supposedly overseeing the Marcos election, and he was very sort of disengaged, and he didn't seem to give a damn about what happened to the Philippine people, which offended me pretty deeply. There's some people out there that I really strongly disagree with, Hillary Clinton chief among them. But I can't say, maybe she used to give me the willies, but ever since there was that wonderful moment and when she was in Iowa at a town meeting, and some fellow at the meeting said, now, well, what experience do you have dealing with evil men? And she just did a deadpan take to the camera, and I laughed. It was the first moment of real fellow feeling I ever had with Hillary. I thought, you know,
did you suspect that was scripted?
Did I suspect it? Of course, but she did it beautifully.
Yeah.
Whether it was or it wasn't.
Back to the phones, 591-7200. And you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Hello, PJ.
Hi.
I have a two-part question.
Sure.
One is, when Milt just asked you about your view on the present state of Iraq, you described really two options, which were the negatives of a withdrawal plan and the negatives of a stay plan. And I thought that the whole Iraq study group was to try and give us a third plan, which would be to try and negotiate these bad outcomes or the specter of these bad outcomes with other stakeholders, which would be negatives to Iraq and Iran as well, and there's a Shia, or the Sunni card that maybe could be played against these two dominant Shiite countries, which are Shiite dominant, but the rest of the Muslim world is Sunni dominant. And the second is the other specter that keeps being raised by the supporters of the war, is what would happen to Iraq as a terrorist training camp. But wouldn't our rested, revitalized military, you know, if we were able to withdraw them and strengthen them, be a force to be reckoned with a post-September 11th approach? You know, knowledge of time is so precious, we wouldn't allow training camps to develop the way they did in the 90s.
I think that's probably true. I think that, as a matter of fact, the war as it's going on right now is a training camp for terrorists. It's probably a better training camp than anything they would be able to do in peacetime. After all, they're getting real hands-on experience being terrorists, aren't they? I got to say, I was a bit dubious about the Iraq Study Group recommendation to negotiate. The history of negotiations in the Middle East, and we've had a lot of them, you know, since 1949, it's really not been terribly productive. And the behavior of, you know, the rational political behavior of Syria and Iran has not been wildly evident. So although, you know, I take their point, and it's not like I think, that they were, like, you know, wrong to suggest it, but it's not something that raises a great deal of hope in my heart.
But if you had to make a decision.
Oh, God. You see, but, you know, the thing is, I don't. And that's why I was saying earlier, sometimes I'm just glad to be, you know, an ordinary hack, you know, and not have to make, you know, I honestly don't know. Sometimes think that our political process, I wish every now and then I heard more politicians say, I honestly don't know. I don't know what the hell to do. And that's my position, and I'm sticking to it.
All right.
We thank you, sir.
Thanks very much.
More journalists would say that, too, I think.
Journalists are rather quick, many of them, to be ultimate experts on just about everything.
You betcha, yeah.
But who in the world would want to be, would aspire to the presidency?
I can't imagine.
You almost get the feeling it's a Groucho Marx situation. You wouldn't want to vote for somebody who wanted to be president.
I feel that way about politics in general. Yeah. I think the fact that someone aspires to a political office probably should disqualify them from holding it. You know? We should have to draft people. We should have to pick them by lottery, yeah, or something.
Back to the phones. And I should say that now we've got a few lines available. If you've been trying to reach us, do certainly try again. Open field for just about any question or thought you've got related to Adam Smith, related to American politics, or related to the current situation in the Middle East or yet elsewhere in this troubled world. And for that matter, related to the career of P.J. O'Rourke. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Hi there.
Yes, hi.
A really interesting conversation tonight. Just wanted to say that.
In what way is this night different from all other nights?
Well, it's applicable to me because I did a study abroad thing in the UK and was an economics class. We talked a lot about Adam Smith, went up to Edinburgh and everything. And we were talking about hypotheticals about how Adam Smith would feel about certain economic topics. And one of the things that we stumbled upon was tort reform. And we had a conversation in terms of how Adam Smith would feel about tort reform, whether he'd support it as something that protects consumers and citizens, or if it would get in the way of the free market. And I was wondering what you thought about that, what Adam Smith would feel about that, and why.
Well, my guess is that, of course, we don't. Smith was going to write a third book. There was a book on jurisprudence that he intended to write, and he never wrote. And we don't know why he never wrote it. I mean, he died. That could have slowed him down a bit. But when he knew he was dying, he had all his notes and drafts that he'd worked on for years about jurisprudence. He had them all burned. And so we don't know what he felt about this, but we do know how strongly he felt about rule of law. And my feeling is that he'd been very much in favor of tort reform, in the sense of getting the courts back to their fundamental purpose of enforcing contract and of adjudicating disputes. You know, these massive class action awards where the participants in them end up getting nothing and the lawyers get huge amounts. These enormous punitive damages that you know, that end up going up all the way up to the Supreme Court and back and forth. All this would seem to get into the in the way of the ordinary day-to-day functioning of the courts and their most important role. So I think if one had to guess, that Smith would be a pretty avidly in favor of tort reform.
Sir, we thank you for the call. What about the man himself? We haven't even talked about that. His dates are 1723 to 1790. So thus he died at around 67, I would say. Did he live a fulfilling life?
He did. He did not lead a terribly interesting life in terms of events, and he did not lead an eventful life. But he was a very social person, and he had a lot of very good friends. He never married. He was quite devoted to his mother and lived with his mother and a maiden aunt. They took in a little Smith cousin who was educated in the household and who turned out to be a man of considerable achievement himself, who became a judge in Scotland. Smith was a very scholarly person, spent a lot of time, most of his time, reading and writing. He was famously absent-minded. There are stories about him being so engaged in a conversation that he put a bread roll in the teapot and poured boiling water over it and poured himself a cup of tea and pronounced it the worst cup of tea he'd ever had in his life. And another time where he was thinking about trying to think through some project and some problem, and he was out in the garden at his mother's house in Kirkcaldy, and he was standing out there in his nightdress and his cap and slippers, and he wandered down the road, and when he came to his senses, he'd walked 14 miles to Dunfermline before he realized that he was wandering around in his pajamas.
We are about to pause to do what Adam Smith would probably approve of. I think he would have thought advertising is a legitimate function in the
world. I believe he would have.
And we return to P.J. O'Rourke. And, P.J., brace yourself. Here's a listener who sent us an email, who's on to you.
Okay.
And knows how you are deceiving us. He says, it's a little longish, but it's worth reading. Unregulated capitalism has a proven track record of failure. The most prosperous countries are those with high tariff barriers, such as Germany, Japan, the U.S. before World War II, Britain before 1850, and today's tiger economies of East Asia. The most technologically advanced nations are those with strong government support of technology. America was better off with high tax rates, with widespread unionization and closed borders. Our economy grew fastest during the 1950s, when marginal tax rates were quite high, and there was no foreign competition to speak of, and our unions were robust. Since the reversal of these trends, the position of the working class has deteriorated. Wages peaked out in 1972 and have now fallen about 30% since then. It is incontrovertible that union busting, free trade, and the shifting of tax burden to the working class has largely been responsible for these developments. When I was growing up in the 1960s, ordinary blue-collar Americans could afford to keep their wives at home and had secure pension plans. Now even the higher reaches of the white-collar workforce no longer has these things. Smith's philosophy is just window dressing for anti-working class policies that are proven to favor the rich.
He does it well, and it would take a book to answer all that, wouldn't it? You know, maybe some of those wives didn't want to be kept at home. I mean, I just bring up that one small point. You know, I come from a blue-collar town. I grew up in Toledo, Ohio. My dad was a car salesman. We were not rich. A lot of the people in the neighborhood worked at the Willys Overland plant. Was about five blocks down the street. A lot of people in the neighborhood worked there. It was kind of a borderline blue-collar, white-collar neighborhood. Some people had lunch pails, and some people sold insurance. And that guy next door was a postman, and guy across the street painted houses and that kind of stuff. You know, when you look back on that world of the 1950s, that golden world of the 1950s, those were modest lives that we led. There wasn't a house on the block that had more than one bathroom. You know, a big vacation was, you know, to go to Lake Muddy or Lake Weedy, you know, in a rented cottage, you know, for a week while it would rain. He had one car. We didn't, because we were in the business. We had one car, and then Dad had a demonstrator, you know, so we had two cars. You know, big deal. You know, there was a television. There was one phone downstairs. It's very hard to measure the difference in welfare of people. You can say that wages peaked and life was so wonderful back there, but back then. But, you know, my dad died, high blood pressure, brain aneurysm. He was 49 years old. You know, modern medical care, even if his company didn't happen to have a good medical plan, modern medical care, he'd probably be alive. Well, maybe not to this day because he'd be 100 this year. But, yeah, he might be. You know, who knows? It was a very different life, and it's not so easy to compare. It isn't so much that I necessarily disagree with leftists or liberals. I mean, I think there are a lot of honest arguments to be had about how much a society should work to redistribute. All societies redistribute resources. There's a price you pay for the redistribution, and there's also benefits that you get. It's an honest argument to have. I sometimes worry about the motivation of leftists in this sense, is that very often they're intent on taking people's freedoms away. They don't see it that themselves. They think of this as leveling. But the root of it is to increase the power of politics and to decrease the power of the individual. And I go back to that thing about wealth, however unevenly distributed, is not zero sum, and political power is zero sum. And I think the 20th century was a long, long lesson in the dangers of excessive political power. I mean, millions and millions of people died because of the excesses of political power, far more than died from the excesses of capitalism, bad as those excesses may have been.
We thank that emailer, and we go back to the phones. 591-7200, the number. You are on the air. Good evening.
Well, good evening, Dr. Rosenberg. Another wonderful program, and I'd like to ask Mr. O'Rourke, well, first of all, what he thinks of the candidate Obama and his candidacy, both his Obama's ideas and his candidacy as it's been going. Secondly, I'd like to know if he would please compare Adam Smith's ideas with G.K. Chesterton's concept of distributism. And then third,
too much, sir. You're overloading us. Let's just take those two.
Yeah, I was going to say, boy,
Obama.
We'll Obama do Obama first. You know, I haven't been paying that much attention. Honestly, you know, I mean, he's nice, and I'll tell you one thing that impresses me most. It's a great mark. It's a benchmark in American racial relations because it is now obviously much more important whether you're cute than whether you're black. This is that's great progress. You know, I mean, I really think it is. So Obama, he's cute and he's nice.
Biden was really talking about, I think.
I think it was what Biden rather awkwardly was talking about.
G.K. Chesterton is compared to Adam Smith.
Well, I just want to say one more thing about it. It's been a long time since a political party has had the nice, cute vote sewn up. You know, I mean, Rudy Giuliani, not so nice. Bill Clinton, don't get cute. You know, I mean, we'll see what happens with Obama. G.K. Chesterton, I've never been able to quite understand what he was getting at with his, I think Chesterton had a kind of nostalgia similar to the emailer that
most Catholic intellectuals, the one who has to classify you as such,
I suppose,
are very fond of G.K. Chesterton.
More fond than I am. I find him a little bit heavy going myself, and I like some of his light poetry. His prose and his philosophizing I don't quite get. I like it that he liked a good strong drink now and again, as I do myself. But I think he had a kind of nostalgia for a feudalism that... Book 3 of The Wealth of Nations, the third section of The Wealth of Nations, is a description of feudalism in Europe and how the free market overturned the feudal barons. And I think G.K. Chesterton could have stood to have read that.
And we go back to the phones, 591-7200. Good evening.
Yes, that emailer who was bemoaning free market capitalism,
you
wouldn't need a book to respond to him, but just a short history of Hong Kong under the British civil servant who's under the governorship, ran Hong Kong with two pages of regulations.
Sir John Copperwaith.
And it was the gem of the world for free market trade. But PJ,
Yeah. Well, thank you. That's a good point. If I'd been a little sharper, I would have said that myself, because I learned about him when I was over covering the Hong Kong handover, and he was a brilliant, brilliant man. He was a career civil servant, kind of got accidentally sent to Hong Kong by a labor government, although he was not a pro-labor guy. And he looked around at Hong Kong, which people thought was a basket case. They thought it was going to be a Bangladesh. They thought it was just going to be a permanent refugee camp. And he said, "I realized that the Chinese were able to do amazing things, and that my main job would be to stay out of their way."
You know, Sam Peltzman in economics at the University of Chicago, is often a guest on this program, did an article or a few some years ago in which he did a fine analysis of Hong Kong as a perfect case in point of free trade, untrammeled by government, elevating a whole society. It was, to be sure, an island society, and now it's been reincorporated into China, though I think they're basically leaving Hong Kong rather alone.
Somewhat. Not quite as much as one might wish, but yeah, so far, not too bad. Not as bad as I'd feared. I'm sorry, you had another, but
You can take a look at our government, juxtapose that, and you take a look at the government's efforts to make things affordable and accessible, like, you know, our pro-union government for the last 60 years, and union membership has dropped precipitously. You know, college tuition through Pell Grants and loans and scholarships, and college tuition has just gone through the roof. Same with health care and insurance and, you know, the AMT. They tried to capture a few millionaires to make them pay taxes, and it's going to capture 25 million.
Right, it's got everybody now.
So that gentleman's email, could, you know, the more government interferes, the less you see benefits, and the cost will soar.
I agree. Experience would so tell us.
You know, and I read avidly, and last year I saw a segment on C-SPAN where the comptroller of the United States of America noted that over 50% of programs in America are a waste of money and are not beneficial. And I never saw anybody write up and say, you know, why don't we start from scratch? You know, all these government programs, they're a lot of hot air and very costly.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
I fear that we've got to dash away and take care of our last round of entrepreneurial messages, and then we return. And P.J. O'Rourke, a member of the Public Policy Studies program at the University of Chicago, has sent me a rather lengthy email with a number of quotations from Adam Smith. I can't read the longer ones, there just isn't time, but I do like this one. It comes from his lectures on jurisprudence, and it's about beer or strong drink. Quote, "Man is an anxious animal and must have his care swept off by something that can exhilarate the spirits."
Bless his soul. Yeah. The it's interesting.
You know, it sounded like W.C. Fields.
Yes, he says things to that effect several other places also about how there's a need for a bit of dissolute behavior between. And he himself liked to drink and liked liked a good dinner and a good party. Those notes I said earlier. You know that Smith destroyed all his notes about jurisprudence, and he did. Those were classroom notes. Two sets of notes from his students were discovered years after his death in somebody's private collection, and they weren't published until well into the 19th century. And so what little we know about what Smith had to say about jurisprudence is actually from classroom notes that were taken. Although, in fairness, they're from pretty early on in his career, and so we don't know to what extent they reflect his mature thinking, although I think we can go with that one.
That attitude would have persisted, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And back to the phones, 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
How you doing?
Fine, sir. Go ahead.
Good. Hey, I just had a comment. I wonder if this country today, given the climate of political correctness and everything else, the hand-wringing, would be able to fight World War II or Korea? I mean, would this country suffer 50,000 dead to save a Korea today?
Well, I don't know, but I'll give you a Smith quote about it. Smith was interrupted at his studies by a young man when Cornwallis surrendered at Yorktown. The young man rushed in to Adam Smith and said, Dr. Smith, we have surrendered at Yorktown. The country is ruined. And Smith said, young man, there is a great deal of ruin in a country. So, I think we might still have the good. We might still have the real stuff in us. I've got to say, I was very impressed both in the Gulf War and when I was in Iraq and Kuwait by the quality of American troops and their abilities and dedication. It's
on this one, the press has been totally unsustaining and totally, just about totally rejecting of that war effort once. We reached 500 casualties or something like that. And, of course, the Democrats have taken the war as a major occasion to grasp power, and that's what political parties are there to do. And that's what they invoked as they took Congress and as they now aspire to take the presidency.
Well, the press, of course, has been taken over by little world savers that should have joined the Peace Corps. You know, I mean, back when I started, I'm just old enough to remember the way the press once was, and it was a blue-collar trade,
mm-hmm.
largely Catholic, as a matter of fact. If you grew up in a poor Catholic neighborhood and you didn't like lifting things for a living and you didn't want to get up first thing in the morning, you had two choices. You could either go into the, and you like to read,
mm-hmm. yeah.
you could either become a newspaper man or go into the church, you know, and so you had to decide between women and booze, you know, and so those that favored women. Anyway, the kind of guy who was a newspaper reporter when I was starting out was the same kind of guy who'd be fighting in a war.
Yeah.
And not the kind of guy who would be sitting at home deciding whether wars were morally justified.
Have the Democrats played it a little bit more cheaply than politicians have to this time?
Oh, yes, they absolutely have. They know this is a conundrum. They know this is an exceedingly difficult situation, and they have been unwilling to go to the public and say, look, we disagree with the president. We understand that these are not easy decisions to make, and this is a decision that we would have made rather than a decision that he did make. No, they haven't given him they haven't treated his decisions with respect. It was a really difficult situation. He may have been wrong, but he did his best, and he tried to figure out a plan. And I don't see the Democrats even trying to figure out a plan.
Nor all the Republicans. There's something to be said, certainly, by an admiration of McCain, if only in that he's risking much of his political capital to stand by the surge operation. And
John's the guy, he's a fighter pilot. Not only that,
sure.
He's a Navy fighter pilot. These guys land jet planes on aircraft carriers. It's the most insane thing. You know, I mean, if you've got the guts to do that, you've got the guts to do anything else. You know, it's way off the subject, but Schindler's List. When I read the Keneally book, I thought Keneally made far too much of a mystery out of where Schindler got the guts to stand up to the mm-hmm. Gestapo. Schindler was a motorcycle racer. Whatever else he may have been in life, you know, a slightly shady businessman, a decent guy at heart or whatever, he was a motorcycle racer. And motorcycle racers are people with so much guts. You know, what was Gestapo to him? I mean, if you've run a motorcycle through a curve on the Nuremberg Ring at 150 miles an hour, you're not going to be scared of some jerk in a trench coat.
That is a great point.